In the millennium year of 2000, director Ron Howard and star Jim Carrey gave the world a satirical look at modern Christmas through the lens of an old classic.
In 2024, we try a bourbon that, Brad, are you ready for this?
Oh, I'm ready.
Is a real workhorse.
The film is How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
The whiskey is Calumet Farms Citation.
And we'll review them both.
This is the Film and Whiskey Podcast.
Welcome to the Film and Whiskey Podcast, where each week we review a classic movie and a glass of whiskey. I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G, and today I am setting the over-under on Bob's score for this movie at 4.5. I guess it would be 4.75, since we're allowed to go in half increments.
Mm. Yeah, you can go whatever you want when you set the over-under.
That is true. I'm going to set it at 4.75, folks. So if you want to take betting, we are now on DraftKings.com each episode.
Actually, you can just Venmo us your bet.
Yes, there you just go. We promise directly to give you send good it. Odds.
Yeah, of course. So, Brad, at the beginning of every episode, I say the phrase, we review a classic movie and a glass of whiskey.
And are we reviewing a classic or what, Bob?
Never has that word been doing more heavy lifting than it is today. Because we are looking at not the actually classic 1960s short, The Grinch. We're looking at Ron Howard's, I don't know what the word is. I don't want to call it abominable, but I want to call it sensory overwhelming experience. The year 2000's The Grinch.
Did you need to go see your therapist after you saw this movie, Bob?
Man, I'll tell you what, dude. Let's set the stage here a little bit. I have been dreading this for weeks, Brad, because I remember this movie being like a little too much even when I was a kid. But because you're a kid and I grew up in an era of Nickelodeon where everybody was sliming each other and everything else.
I just see little 10-year-old Bob sitting with his arms crossed, like his leg crossed over the other, tapping
Paul
his
Rumfing.
Foot.
Yes.
Yes. Like, it was a little much.
I mean, I can't say you're wrong. I would like to say that you're wrong, but
your little sisters are over there like, wow, Grinch, what a great movie. And you're just like ruining everybody's Christmas.
let me get to my point more quickly than I intended to. I know I can be long-winded. Brad, I think this is actually a really important historical document because I don't know that future generations will be aware of like what it was like to consume media as children of the 90s. Like, what were we being fed? Our media diet and Nickelodeon stuff. It was just there was so much overwhelming sensory experience. Everything was tangible. Everything was about getting slimed and the garish, really bright visual colors. And, I think this is born out of 1990s overbearing entertainment. Like this,
I was gonna say,
this is just as related to Nickelodeon as it is to like that crappy Godzilla remake that we've been referencing from the late 90s. It is the culmination of a half decade of visual and auditory assaults on the senses. And I think that it's kind of like, I want to put it in a museum. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I was going to say, if you want a shorter version than having to watch this movie, go on YouTube and just look up the old Sonic the Hedgehog ads for Sega. And like, to me, those are like peak 90s ridiculousness. I look back on those. I'm like, what did they think that they were doing? Like, why? Like, how did that attract people? Mm-hmm. But I mean, it did. I guess we spent money on these things. We obviously spent money on How the Grinch Stole Christmas, Bob, because this was it the highest grossing movie of 2000?
Yeah. So we've been going on domestic gross for every movie we've reviewed this season. Oh, and by the way, if this is your first episode, welcome into Film and Whiskey. We usually talk about better movies. TM. That's our
Bob,
slogan.
You do know that if there's somebody new to this episode, it's probably because they like this
love
movie.
This movie. And I am so sorry for what's about to happen.
And your first words to them are, we usually do better films than this one, the one that got you
your favorite movie. Yeah. So this season, we are looking at high-grossing films. So usually it's the highest-grossing film from each year from 1988 to 2019. We have landed in the year 2000, where we are actually doing the highest-grossing domestic film. I think it was only like sixth highest-grossing worldwide, but people in America ate this up. And Brad, you're absolutely right, man. I think that if this is really a spiritual cousin to any form of media, it's not even just like the TV and movies of the late 90s, it's the commercials.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that like one of the most generous things I can say about this movie is that everything's intentional. Like, I don't think they decided like, I think it would look cool if we did this. And then they just made a movie where every single shot is a Dutch angle. Like, it's doing this on purpose. And if I'm putting on my thinking cap, I think it's because Ron Howard, a very good director, was trying on purpose to mimic the advertisements and commercials of the late 90s to help underscore the point of his movie, which is anti-commercialism. Like it makes sense why he chose to do it. He definitely made choices. The question is, were those choices the appropriate choices and did they work? And Brad, I am very excited to hear your thoughts on that today. But before we get into that, it's time for our first segment of the day, which we call Brad Explains.
Brad's going to give us the movie plot with only 60 seconds ticking on the clock. So let's go ahead and hear your take with this little segment that we call Brad Explains.
Brad Explains is the part of the podcast where Brad breaks down the plot of the movie that he has just seen, often for the first time. The million-dollar question right now, Brad, is this your first time with Ron Howard's Grinch?
It is not. I did not see it as a child, as you would have imagined. In fact, I never even watched Nickelodeon. I don't know if I've ever seen an actual episode of Slime Time. What was that show called?
Oh, Slime Time Live. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, never once saw a single episode of that. I did, however, watch this probably in my college years.
Oh, what a weird... Man. I just want to spend the whole episode hearing about that, because that seems like if there's any age to get introduced to this movie, that's like the worst possible age, because you're not old enough to have your own kids yet, but you have no nostalgia for it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm fascinated.
I think it actually hit well in the college years, because we're all kind of idiots when we're in college.
Sure.
And we think that stupid stuff is funny. Mm-hmm. And so I remember walking away from it thinking like, oh, yeah, like that was pretty funny. I think that was my takeaway, like B minus, maybe a C plus. That was kind of funny. Jim Carrey is a unique talent. That probably would have been my takeaway. About 4 or 5 years later, I had a friend who it's like one of his favorite movies of all time. And so I watched it with him and enjoyed how much he enjoyed the film. And then I watched it for this viewing, Bob.
You're such a good friend.
Dude, I love my friends. Man. I am very kind to them, especially you, Bob.
I was going to say, in terms of Jim Carrey movies that Brad thinks are not that great, it does blow my mind that you gave Eternal Sunshine a 2.5 out of 10 and are primed to give this movie a much higher score.
Oh, easily.
Oh, my gosh, dude.
Easily higher than Eternal Sunshine.
I need new friends, film and whiskey. All right, Brad. So this was not your first time seeing the movie. Folks, it's The Grinch. I don't really know what there is to spoil here, but spoiler alert, Brad's going to break down the plot of the movie. You have 1 minute on the clock, Brad, and go.
All right. So imagine the 1950s Grinch, but instead the Grinch wants to bone one of the main Whos in Whoville. Mm-hmm. And like, that's all you really need to know, folks. That's the kind of movie we're watching.
Yep. The end.
Is that a good, yeah, is that
absolutely.
A good summary?
This is just like a deeply mean, ugly, horny movie. And when I say ugly, like it is visually a very ugly movie, but it's also just like, it truly does embody like the late 90s and the early 2000s in terms of what we put on screen, like the values that we A, pretended to have, but B, actually had, like the objectification of women, the like the weird, violent, like children. Like, it's just a really great encapsulation of pre 9/11, but post late 90s. This might be the most important movie of the last 5 years we've talked about, Brad.
Bob, I feel like you're just going to continue to compliment how like unique to its era this film is to like cushion the 2.5 you're going to give it at the end of the
What if I end up talking myself into like, this is an absurdist masterpiece. 8.5 out of 10.
Bob, let's be really honest. This is an absurdist masterpiece.
I mean, it's absurd.
I don't know if it makes it a good movie, but it, like, it's a masterpiece of what Ron Howard is setting out to do.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Ron Howard as a director. I have gone on my soapbox many times for Ron Howard because I think that, like Clint Eastwood and like Steven Spielberg, he often champions the everyman, but his direction is the most kind of muted of the three of them. Like, you can't really, there's not as much of a directorial signature as, you know, like Spielberg. You can always tell when you're watching a Spielberg movie.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while, Ron Howard will do something that is just way outside of his wheelhouse. Like, this is the guy that made multiple Da Vinci Code movies. And you forget, like, oh, he made those Da Vinci Code movies. That doesn't seem like a Ron Howard movie. And then you remember, oh, yeah, he made, like, one of the worst Star Wars movies ever. That was also Ron Howard. So he just, every now and then, he's like, I'm going to test the waters elsewhere. And it almost never works out for my guy.
Which Star Wars movie did he make?
He did Solo.
Oh, that was Ron Howard?
Well, he only gets half credit for that because it was like almost made and then they pulled the directors off of it and Ron Howard was brought in to like try to salvage it. So, you know, like I don't blame him for that
one.
He did not. Unsalvageable.
Bob, as a Star Wars fan, I will tell you, I've never seen Solo.
It's not even like bad. It's just like the most boring and forgettable movie. As you're watching it, you're like, oh, yeah, I forgot. This is about Han Solo, right? Like every scene. Anyway, all that to say, Brad, I like one of my boldest claims today is going to be, I think this is like the most directing Ron Howard has ever done in a movie. Like, he's really trying for an aesthetic here. I don't know what you would even call what he's trying to go for here, but it's very obvious that he is making big choices.
I think that what he's going for is trying to turn a children's like animated cartoon book into a message of morality that wasn't in the original book.
Mm.
And it becomes something vastly different. Now, here's the thing, Bob. Do you feel like the consumeristic urge that has dominated Christmas is good?
I do not. I will go on record and say no.
So what's your problem with this movie then, man? He's on your side. He's on your team, Bob.
That's it, man. That's how movies work, right? Like,
that's it.
If we agree with the central message of the movie, then the movie must be good.
Yeah.
We did an episode, Brad, about the Christian movie industrial complex.
And every single Christian movie is perfect,
is good, Bob. Based on our criteria and logic. Yeah.
So I think I wanted to point that out to say, like, both of us agree with the underlying message of this film.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're not going to sit here and lambast him for trying to make a movie about, hey, like, the spirit of Christmas is probably something other than buying a million gifts.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of my favorite scenes of the film is when Cindy Lou Who has the giant thing of Christmas presents near the start of the film, and he pulls out the one from the middle to see her face, which is a great little like frame within a frame.
Mm-hmm.
And she just really quietly goes, I don't know if this is what Christmas is all about, Daddy. And it's the most sweet, precious little moment of the film. And it might be one of the only quiet moments of the film. Mm-hmm. And I loved it.
Yeah. And so, man, I think, Brad, how I'd like the first half of this episode to go is because we're already diving into kind of the analysis part of it. My two big problems with this movie are interrelated. The first one is the difficulties of adapting a story that is meant to be short into an almost 2-hour movie, and the, you know, the additions that they have to make to fill out the runtime, and whether those are successful or not. And then B, as a result of that, I feel like the underlying message of the movie is kind of similar, but the characterization is completely different. Like, the Who's in the short film are completely different than the Who's in this movie. And I think they're trying to kind of update it for, you know, quote unquote, modern times. But I do feel like it kind of undermines the point of the movie, the way that they portray these characters. So I don't know if you're OK with it. Let's kind of just go through both of those points. And I want to start with an episode we released multiple Christmases ago where we had a debate about which short animated film was better for Christmas time, Charlie Brown Christmas or The Grinch.
What an episode.
Now, you have very famously said, A, that you love Charlie Brown Christmas, and B, The Grinch has never really worked for you, the original Grinch cartoon. Yes. And part of your reasoning, as I recall, was that you just don't really like the animation style of Dr. Seuss.
Yes,
which is
not
totally fair.
Just don't like is a very, very light encapsulation of the hatred.
Really? It's that bad to you?
Oh, I think it is one of the most hideous animation styles I've ever seen in my life.
Interesting. Okay, I didn't realize it was that. Really, I thought it was more just like, yeah, I don't care for it, you know?
Oh, no, I like, and I'm not, the animators for the Christmas special, I'm not blaming them. I hate Dr. Seuss's art style.
Got it.
Period. I think it's horrendous. The animators did a great job of mimicking it and putting it to screen. I think it's terrible.
Okay. All right. We got that out off your chest. We're good. We can move past that. I did want to ask, though, so you don't really care for that special, but like, I mean, you have a good grasp on the way that it's told and the underlying message of it.
Yeah.
What do you think about the way that they, quote unquote, fleshed out the story for the 2-hour version? Like, because to me, Brad, when I think about this story, like it is a parable, almost the same way that Charlie Brown Christmas is like a parable. It's just a very short. It's not supposed to have a lot of context. You're not supposed to know why the Grinch hates the Who's. He just does. He's a guy who hates the Who's, and the Who's love Christmas. And to give him the backstory that they give him in this movie and all the things they flesh out, it's like you tried to make the impact of the parable better by giving it more context, but in doing so, you actually rob it of all of its power. Jesus's parables in the New Testament, you know, my guy knew what he was doing. If those yes. if those parables were, you know, multiple chapters long, they would lack the rhetorical power. So, like, I guess just on like a rhetoric level, Brad, like, did they ruin it here?
Honestly, Bob, my curiosity is, so, obviously, your opinion is that, yes, they did ruin it. I guess I'll speak to that point. I don't think that they ruin necessarily the moral of the story with most of the characterization. Like, I honestly kind of like the idea of the Grinch being a part of the society and then being rejected because of his skin color and his just robust facial hair, if we can put it that way.
Mm.
None of that bothers me. I think that the only characterization that just feels so far out of left field is how deeply, what's her name? Martha May something.
Oh, yeah. Christine Baranski.
Wants to have sex with the Grinch.
I mean, like, bad, dude. Like,
so bad.
Sister
it's
needs
so
it.
Weird. And like, if they literally just fully cut that piece out of the story, or like, not even cut it out of the story, it's just poorly directed. Like, I like that he thought that this girl was cute. Like, that is so relatable to be somewhat of a loser in your class, at least self-perceived that way, and think that the cute girl in the class might ever like you. Mm-hmm. Like that, like that's a classic storyline that we can all relate to. It gets weird when they become adults.
Yeah.
And I think that a different director might have done a better job with it. But that's the primary point for me that kind of muddles the entire message of the original Grinch.
Yeah, the way I see it, they add two crucial things to fill out the runtime. Number one is they try to answer the question of, like, why does the Grinch hate Christmas / the Whos? And then the second is, like, they try to add context to the Whos themselves. So, like, instead of in the original version, like, they are not really caught up in consumerism. In this version, they have to overcome their own consumerism. Like, that's their obstacle to overcome. And I think they both have their own flaws. But the biggest flaw of the movie for me is, like, those two stories are kind of happening separate from each other. So, like, the Grinch hates Christmas, but only as an extension of the Who's loving it. Like, he doesn't really hate Christmas so much as he hates the Who's. And he had a really traumatic experience happen to him around Christmas. But when they have this flashback and they show that the Grinch was, like, absolutely bullied and humiliated by grown women and children and then yes. forced into exile as a small child, like, what is actually happening there has nothing to do with the consumeristic attitude of the Whos. It's like the Whos are awful, awful people, and their consumerism is only one facet of how they're awful. And so the end of the movie attempts to fix this by them overcoming their consumeristic impulses. But, like, they don't fix anything else. Like, they're still racist. They're still, like, they're just horrible, horrible people. And I think that's, like, that's the thing that pisses me off, is, like, it tries to manipulate you into thinking, like, oh, they've overcome this one thing, so now we can, like, cheer for them. Absolutely not. Like, I want the Grinch to go Django Unchained on this entire village. I would like to see an absolute bloodbath at the end of this movie, because those people deserve it more than anyone else.
How the Grinch Stole Christmas, Django edition.
I don't know, man. Am I far off in my assessment here? I feel like they tried to patch up a whole host of awful, sinful things these people do by, like, having them fix one sinful thing they do.
Sure. I think that the problem here is that Ron took things, he allowed it to go too far.
It is Ron's fault. It's all Ron's fault.
It is Ron's fault. Like, and I say that because he is the one who chose the general timbre of the film. Mm-hmm. Like the sound and the garishness that we talked about earlier. Everything is so over the top in order to portray Americans' ridiculous consumption habits, but he never pulls the reins in on any other elements of it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that you end up with the Grinch being the most over-the-top Grinch you will ever see in your life, and the Whos being the most over-the-top Whos.
Right.
And the storyline being the most over-the-top storyline.
Yeah, and it undermines exactly what they're trying to say, because, like, you know, even if we grant him that, like, the way he's shooting this movie is supposed to be a reflection of the commercialism of the 90s or whatever, it's not like they stop doing it at any point in the movie. Like, the movie is a giant commercial based on the way they shot it. So I'm with you, man. Like, it does, like, well, it seems like it's trying to make points, but then it's undermining its own points.
Also, it undermines it in a very simple way. Like, that isn't even done over the top. Like, at this point, the movie's calmed down some. But, like, the whole point of the movie is, like, we don't need presents. We just need each other, right? Kindness, human goodness and decency. But they still get the presents at the end of the movie. Mm-hmm.
So this brings me, like, go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, they still end up with the thing that they should not
they
have had.
They fix nothing about themselves. These people suck. Okay.
Here's a curiosity for me. This is more general, Bob. Last week we watched The Phantom Menace. Mm-hmm. And I specifically remember you saying, man, why didn't they just give us a 10-minute background on Qui-Gon Jinn or Obi-Wan or Darth Maul? And here we have one of your favorite movies, The Grinch, getting a little bit of background, and it is not your cup of tea.
It is not.
So what's So what gives? How do we reconcile these two things, Bob?
It's a good question, Brad. And I think the real answer is that I am just not a consistent person. But my actual answer is going to be, like, I really do just think this story is a 30-minute story. Like, if you read the book to your child, it will take you about 30 minutes. If you watch the 30-minute version, it takes you, guess how long? 30 minutes to get through it. It's a perfectly told story in 30 minutes. And trying to stretch it out to 2 hours is just it's a bad idea. Like, they made another Grinch movie in, I think, 2018, an animated one with Benedict Cumberbatch voicing the Grinch. And it's also not good because, like, guess what? You are just padding the runtime when, even if it's an hour and a half long, you're putting an hour of filler into this story. So, like, I wanted more Qui-Gon because I feel like The Phantom Menace is a 2 hour story. You know, actually 2 hour plus, right? But
sure,
like, it needs to be filled out even more because it's being told on this big canvas. Whereas The Grinch is like, it is intended to be a very simple story. And it doesn't need the context that they're trying to, like, force onto it.
Now, I will say, Bob, in defense of my boy Ronnie, this is an hour and 44 minute movie. Mm-hmm. And I looked when the credits came up and it was at an hour and 38 minutes.
Sure.
So this is very nearly a 90 minute film.
Yeah.
Bob.
And I will still say 60 minutes too long, Brett.
you would prefer the 38 minute.
I sure
Jim
would.
Carrey
where
version?
No one's horny. Like, very, very importantly,
joke's on you. That's the 38 minutes.
the R-rated version, just the horny parts. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about the second part of what I was saying, which is, like, the characterization's changing. And Brad, you know, I do think that at the end of the day, the message is Christmas isn't about consumerism. Like, we reached that conclusion when we were talking about Charlie Brown. Like, they both kind of say the same thing. But what I really love about the original Grinch is that the way they get to that point is that if you really think about the Grinch, it's that he's been misunderstanding them the whole time. Like, he thinks, like, he you know, he's looking down at Whoville and he's like, I can't stand all the noise from their toys. And I sure. just hate that they're making all this cacophony. So what am I going to do? I'm going to go steal it all from them. Because in his mind, he's thinking they make lots of noise with this, so they must love these things. And I hate when they gather around and sing. I just hate it. I'm going to take it all away from them and then they'll be sad. And the big reveal is, like, presents are fine, but they never cared about the presents to begin with. And it's when he hears them singing in the absence of their stuff that he has a change of heart. It's a really beautiful story. And so, like, it's anti-consumerist, but it's anti-consumerist because the Grinch misunderstood them. Whereas in this movie, they freaking suck. And he's right about them the whole time. And so his plan to get back at them is to steal all their stuff, but it's more of a revenge story than anything. And so at the end of the movie, like, they have a change of heart, but they decide, like, we don't want to be sucky anymore. So let's embrace the spirit of being together. But it completely changes the calculus of the Grinch needing to have a change of heart. Like, he had a change of heart in the first one because he had fundamentally misunderstood them to begin with. And in this movie, they're the ones misunderstanding the Grinch. And I just don't feel like it sticks that landing. Like, it tries to arrive at the same place, but it completely flips the characterization of the Who's and the Grinch to try to do it. And I just don't feel like it works as well. And I'd like to hear your thoughts, because you're a guy that doesn't like the Grinch anyway, so it probably doesn't matter to you. But, like, I mean, do you know what I'm getting at here?
Oh, 100%. Can I get biblical here for a second,
Oh,
Bob?
Please do.
Like, the essence of being a Christian in a lot of ways is summed up by Jesus when he talks about, like, the world will know you, Christians, by the love that you have for one another. And this is in the middle of a passage where he's talking about, like, leaving them and darkness and suffering. And the implication is, when things are really terrible and life is insanely difficult, which, as we all know, happens a lot, you will be known by the love that you have for one another. And I think that's kind of what the original Grinch is getting at, mm-hmm. right? Like, when things are really bad, when you're suffering, quote unquote, and it's a children's story, so suffering equals losing your toys. What do we recognize? Oh, wow, they actually love each other. And it's the recognizing of that that converts the Grinch, mm-hmm. if you'll allow the metaphor to continue. In this one, Ron recognizes like one or two elements of that and is like, but also I hate commercialism and we're just going to focus on that.
Yep.
Like, we're just going to focus on the consumerism and how much I hate that. And it's been so in his face for about 20 years now. Like, 80s and 90s are not known for their subdued nature. and so it would make sense that he would want to mock the last 20 years by making the most ridiculous version of it possible. And so I think that's why, to me, Bob, I almost just consider them completely separate films.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that, because you kind of have to. Like, you can't think of them the same, because they are two completely different movies that are trying to make, like I said, they're trying to make the same point, but they're really not. They're making two completely separate points from each other as well. Brad, I know, before we go any further, I won't talk about the old Grinch anymore, because you've provided a good segue out of it. But I have to say, what I love about the old Grinch is that we don't even know what the Grinch's relationship is with Whoville. Like, we don't know if they've ever seen him before. He just hates them. He just lives on a mountain and hates these people. And their first exposure to him may be him stealing their stuff. It would explain why Cindy Lou Who doesn't recognize him and thinks that he's Santa Claus and buys into all his lies, because they are such a naive and welcoming people. And when this dude has his change of heart after seeing them singing around their tree, and he speeds down the mountain, it's so crudely animated because they're like standing in a circle and they open the circle up for the Grinch to come in, but they animate it like the people are like a hinged door and they just like swing open and let him in. It's such a great picture of like who these people are. They never cared about the toys. They never cared about the stuff. At their core, they're like a beautiful, welcoming people. And the moment that he turns and comes to them, they welcome him with open arms and they let him carve the freaking roast beast. And in this movie, like, the Grinch comes riding into town, and the only reason that they welcome him is because they're like, he's doing to us what we've been doing to him for 50 years. Like, look what we hath mm-hmm. wrought. And then they're like, maybe we shouldn't suck so much. And again, like, that's an effective way to tell a story. It is not the Grinch. This thing is an abomination to Grinches
it
everywhere.
Must burn. Bob, I am going to take How the Grinch Stole Christmas to the finals of our bracket at the end of the year.
I can burn it.
Just so that it lives on forever and is never so burnt.
All right, Brad, we have done all the analysis on this movie and we haven't talked about performances at all, but I think this is a good place for us to stop. Let's drink some whiskey. We'll come back and we'll talk about Ronnie and Jimmy and all the people involved in this movie. What do you say?
Let's get to it, man. Although I'm not sure if there's anybody else involved than Jim Carrey. All right, everybody. Today we are drinking Calumet 16-Year Citation. Mm. Now, Bob, I don't know a ton about Calumet Farms, but I do know that they have a special limited release series that honestly comes out pretty sporadically,
mm-hmm.
and they're naming them these special releases after the different Triple Crown winners. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't remember if it's actually just Triple Crown winners or if it's just like famous racehorses, but, you know, Citation is one of the most legendary horses to ever win the Triple Crown. If you drive through Lexington, like, there is a Citation Road or Citation Boulevard. I'm getting nerdy now, Brad, but anyway, Calumet Farms. Brad, we had a listener write into us, and in fact, it was our friend Wes who provided these Calumet samples to us to correct us on what we know or don't know about Calumet. So last week, I called Calumet Farms a non-distilling producer, which is true. I said that they were sourcing their whiskey from Western Spirits, which I don't know very much about. And Wes corrected me to say that Western Spirits is also a non-distilling producer. So this is actually Barton whiskey that is being aged at a warehouse owned by Western Spirits. And Calumet is just a brand that Western Spirits puts out. So sure, fine. This is still a non-distilling producer that is giving us what we now know to be Barton juice. So Brad, this particular whiskey is a 16-year-old from their single rack black label. We talked about this a little bit last week. They pull all these whiskeys from one rack in the Rick House. They say that it is the optimal conditions. I think they're never more than like 19 barrels in a blend. And this is the oldest one we've had by a lot, Brad. This is 16 years old. I'm a little worried because even last week at 14 years old, I think that thing was approaching being over-oaked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I've not found many 12-plus bourbons that survive the oaking.
Mm-mm. The oaking. That sounds like a horror movie.
The oakening.
The oaking. All right. We're sitting at 106 proof today. We are at 74% corn, 18% rye, 8% malted barley. Brad, let's freaking drink this thing. What are you picking up on the nose?
This is a really pleasant nose. It doesn't stand out in any powerful ways, but it gives me some really nice vanilla. There's caramel. It's very like a rich cream cheese. And there's a little bit of like a sweet mint going on that I really like. It's very pleasant. I give it an 8 out of 10 here on the nose.
I'm really close to you because I actually think your notes are right on. But that minty note, I think sometimes tips into smelling like straight ethanol, almost like rubbing alcohol. And so I can't tell from moment to moment, like, is this just really herbaceous or is it like chemically almost? And so that's the only thing is I'm a little wary of this alcohol note. Like, is it going to really kick me in the mouth when I take a sip here? It's pleasant. I'm going to give it a 7.5 on the nose.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think it's the mint note that's giving you that. I think it's the ethanol.
Thank you.
Just a little correction. on the palate here, the first note that I have is, wow, that's oaky.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is a lot of oak going on here. Once you kind of push past that with the second and third sip, there's some cocoa powder. The vanilla continues through. I got like a nice like raisin type of vibe. It's got a little bit of a coffee, ground coffee smell to it. I came down a little bit on the palate. I'll give it a 7 out of 10 here. It's good product. It should be like 12 or 13 years, not 16.
Brad, I'm in a very interesting position right now because you sound like Bob Book right now. You sound like a guy who, I'm not saying you're lying about your position or even couching it in nice things, but you're like, you know, if you think about this, and I'm going to be the Brad G here because you said the words, hey, once you push past the first sip and give it a second and third sip, it gets better. Brad G would look me in the eye and say, Bob, you shouldn't have to give it three sips to think that it's a good whiskey.
Yeah, that's true.
So I'm going to be the Brad G here. This is too oaky. It just is. And that first sip, dude, like it was the front of my palate. And then you said, oh, yeah, it's on the front of your palate. And I was like, OK, hopefully I will push through this all the way through. Oak, oak, oak. And it's like you get just the faintest glimmer of sweetness. And then it is swallowed up once again by just straight woody notes. It's certainly something, man. I'm sure there are people out here who love their whiskey to taste like this. This is just not, you know, I like my decadent, rich whiskeys. This is not that, man. I'm going to give it a 5.5 on the taste.
Wow. Yeah, I'll just go on to the finish. For the finish, I'm at a 7.5. I think that the oak continues through very strong, as you said. I get a little bit of black pepper, a little bit of leather. It has some of those kind of classic bourbon finishing notes that you would have from a more heavily oaked whiskey. 7.5. Decent finish on a decent whiskey.
I'm going to give it a 7.5 too. And I'm going to, you know, I'm going to pull a Bob Book now. When we were at the New York whiskey competition, Brad, we got one sip to judge these things. That's it. I mean, like, if you really wanted to take a second sip, you would. But we're drinking like 100 samples a day. So you're pretty much taking your notes based off of one sip. You are absolutely correct in that the second and third sip on this are significantly better. Much more caramel, much more brown sugar here. And that's going to bump my finish score up a little bit. Because when I think about like a finish, I'm thinking about the lasting impact of the whiskey. And I include like a second sip in that. I'm going to give it a 7.5 here. But my balance score, I can't pin down, dude. Because this is like, this was a wild ride.
Yeah, I think that it's a wild ride and not in a great way. So I'm going to put my balance score at a 7 out of 10. There's a little bit of complexity here, enough for me to enjoy it. It's just so heavily oaked that I can't go any higher than a 7.
Man, I want to use this in like an infinity bottle. I feel like this could give so much character to a bigger bottle of whiskey. Like, you add these 2 ounces and it's like a cheat code to just making your stuff more complex. But it almost reminds me of, you know, how they make poor man's Pappy, where you blend Weller Antique and Weller 12 year. And we've always said the antique is like all the flavor and the 12 year is all the spice and character. This is like that. This is like the Weller 12 of the Calumets we've had so far, Brad.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it a 6.5 on balance. And I don't even know what this costs, Brad. What's the value on this?
Bob, I'm seeing it for $150 online, and that's the only one I can see. It's at this point, it is a very hard to find bourbon.
Yeah, I'm seeing a review from back in 2022 when it came out at $138 then. So it doesn't seem like it's been marked up that much. It was just expensive to begin with.
Yep.
I don't think this is a poorly made whiskey. Like, I think this is a really great example of a 16-year-old bourbon. I just don't like 16-year-old bourbon. Now, like, it's sourced. It's from a premium brand. Everything's always going to be expensive. Like, I don't know, Brad, that I think $138 is actually exorbitant for this. Do you?
Triple digits is tough, man.
Like, I wouldn't pay for this because I don't like it. But
yeah,
if this is what you're looking for, I don't think this is like gouging people. Like, if this was called Weller 16, it would, you know, it'd be on the secondary market for $400. You know, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that this is like a $70 to $90 whiskey. I think $110 isn't gouging. I think anything much above that is.
All right. So let's say $90 is where it should be. So they're charging like at least $40, $50 more than it should be. I'm still going to give this like a 6 out of 10 on value. I don't like it, but I think you could do worse. I think there's much poorer decisions you can make in terms of value on whiskeys.
Yes, I would agree with that. I'll give it a 3.5.
Oof.
I don't think this is a good value at $140, man. That's a lot of money, and you could go buy so many other whiskeys, Bob, that is like 7 bottles of Rebel 100. Tell me you
could get so drunk. All right, man, I am coming out to a 33 out of 50, which is higher than I thought. But again, I think this is a pretty well-made whiskey, so I'm okay with it. Where are you at?
would you guess that we're at the exact same score?
I want that to be exactly how we shake out on this movie too, Brad.
Yes.
All right. Now, would you recommend this is the question.
If you're not paying for it, I would say it is worth a pour. Maybe if you could find a pour for like $15-$20 and like, you know what you're getting into, I'd say, sure, maybe try this. I would not recommend a bottle.
What do you think this would go well with? Like, if we're food pairing, because, you know, like Lagavulin goes really well with a steak, because we've been talking about this, because like the steak almost takes away the salinity of the Lagavulin.
Yes.
But you get the smoke a little bit too. So like this, I don't know if this would go well with a steak, but it definitely, like, you couldn't drink this with like fish or chicken. It's too oaky. Like, it needs something with a ton of flavor. I think it's a dessert bourbon. Like, it's got to be beef, right?
Nope, it's not beef. This has to go with like an insanely long smoked pulled pork or like a brisket, maybe. I think that this has to go with just the juiciest pulled pork you've ever had in your
life.
That
makes sense because there's so much oak. Like, it'd have to be something smoked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Well, there you go, folks. Get yourself a brisket and a bottle of Calumet 16. Brad, let's get back into talking about the Grinch. What do you say?
Let's get to it. All right, everybody. That was Calumet 16-year citation of whiskey that will just cost you too much money, Bob.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know it's not going to cost you any money at all?
What's that, Brad?
Two facts and a falsehood!
Brad is going to try to stump you, Bob. Two are right and one is wrong. Two facts and a falsehood.
Two facts and a falsehood is the part of the podcast where Brad presents me with three items as fact about the making of this movie, one of which he has just completely made up. And I have to guess which one that is. Brad, I am sitting at 9-4 on the season.
You're rocking it, man.
One of those losses is doubled because Noah Gattel, or some, was it Noah? I think it was Noah. Somebody steered me wrong. They done me wrong, and I took on an extra L. So the numbers don't add up to the number of episodes in our season, but that's because we have crazy rules.
What's the line in whose line is it anyways?
The games are made up and the points don't matter. Yeah,
and the points don't matter.
that's 100% what this is, man. All right, hit me with the two facts and a falsehood, Brad.
Fact number one, Jim Carrey was suggested for the title role by Audrey Geisel, the widow of Dr. Seuss, who controlled the rights to the book. She also suggested Jack Nicholson, Dustin Hoffman, and Robin Williams. Fact number two, Jim Carrey would often smoke in order to cope with the stress caused by the intense makeup process. However, as his suit was covered in yak hair, he had to use a very long cigarette holder in order to avoid a potential fire hazard. Fact number three, the role of Max the dog was auditioned for by 47 different pooches, with the final winning dog being Chip, a mixed breed 3-year-old puppy.
These are good, man. I actually have no idea. So fact number one is interesting because I read enough about the making of the movie that I know that when they first started pitching the rights to the story, Dr. Seuss's widow stipulated, like, it has to be somebody on the level of a Jack Nicholson or a Dustin Hoffman in terms of, like, I don't know what the term is, you know, popularity, purchasing power, right?
Mm-hmm. She was greedy, is what you're saying.
No, she just, well, I guess so. But like, you know, I think this movie is very much like the weird 2000 commercialized version of like Tim Burton's Batman. So it kind of makes sense that like you'd want Jack Nicholson to be the star, like the way that he was the Joker. She wanted somebody to be the Grinch. Now, does that mean that she actually suggested Jack Nicholson? I don't know. Or did the person who wrote that IMDb thing understand exactly what she was saying? I don't know. Fact number two sounds funny just because I could, like, the Grinch with a long cigarette holder just seems like the perfect thing to put in the Grinch's hand with those yes. long fingers and stuff. Fact number three, I just don't care. Like, I don't care how many pooches they auditioned. So that could be made up. I truly do not care.
Screw the dogs.
Yeah, forget that dog.
Forget that dog. Come on, man. Max is a very cute dog.
Yep. Hey, can I tell you something else?
Yeah.
Max is probably dead by now.
Yeah, he probably is.
That dog's dead. All right, so. Fact number one.
That was dark, man. Jeez.
I'm going to say fact number one is the falsehood just on that technicality, but I think I'm wrong.
You are, in fact, wrong, Robert.
Which one was it?
It was number three was the falsehood.
Yeah. See, here's the thing. I don't care.
That's what I need to do more often. Write falsehoods that you just don't give a rip about.
Like, I really like dogs. I just, like, you know.
Convince me, Bob.
How am I ever to care about, like, the number of dogs that what was false about it? Did you just make it completely up, or?
There was a fact on IMDb about there being, like, three different dogs that played Max, and I think that they were mixed breed, but, like, there was nothing about the name of the dog or how many different dogs auditioned or anything like that.
I didn't even think about the possibility that there was more than one dog. It's like the Olsen twins on Full House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought about that when I wrote the fact. I was like, I feel like if I write something about there being multiple dogs, you're going to sniff that out more than if I just say there was one.
I would sniff it out.
Yeah, see what I did there?
All right, man. You've got me at 9-5 on the season now. Still got a little bit of cushion, but things are getting dicey here. Brad, let's talk not about the dog in the movie, but let's talk about the Grinch himself, Jim Carrey. Here's the thing, man. You could write the article about this movie that's like, oh, the Grinch is such a relic of its time, like Bob Book said, and it's because of this crazy, unhinged performance by Jim Carrey. I actually think Jim Carrey's performance makes so much sense in the context of this movie. And in fact, is less crazy and wild than the filmmaking going on around him. Like, it seems like a very grounded performance. And he's under so much makeup that you have to go that big or else it would seem like a really flat performance. The fact that he's able to emote and move around as much as he is, it's kind of a minor miracle. Like, I think it's a really, really good performance, Brad.
I'm 100% with you, man. And can I take a second just to extol the virtues of practical effects?
Mm.
Like, this is a hell of a costume.
Oh, my gosh.
Very famously drove Jim Carrey insane. The costume director who put him into it every day nearly quit because Carrey was so difficult to work with. Like, it's almost legendary how terrible of a costume it was to get on. But I'll tell you what, man, I don't know if I've ever seen a better, just ridiculous costume that looks perfect.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, like, the way they shoot this movie, I hate the cinematography, Brad. Like, it's just, it's ugly. There's, like, sometimes there's a weird fog filter on top of everything. Everything's at an angle. The angles themselves, they reveal too much of the sets a lot of times, so it doesn't look like a real town. It looks like a set.
Mm-hmm.
And even with all that going on around him, like, I never was looking at Jim Carrey's costume going, like, that's a costume. Like, it is, it's one of the best costumes I've ever seen. It's, like, incredible.
And the performance underneath it is spectacular. And it's because Carrey is such a brilliant comedian. And he knows, like there are moments in the asinine ridiculousness of his performance.
Mm-hmm.
There's moments where he draws it in and he almost like, he often uses his body in a very big, wide fashion when he's engaging with the Whos. And he, like, it's almost like he's trying to get big for a bear and like scare them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when he's on his own in the cave on the top of the mountain, like, the scene where he's putting together his schedule, he's drawn in on himself, he's inwardly focused, and like, Carrey just has a talent for this type of comedy that I don't know if anybody else has.
I will say, like, that part of the movie was the worst part for me. Like, the first half of this movie, for many reasons, was like unwatchable. Like, once the actual plot kicks in and he's like, I'm going to steal Christmas, the movie gets a lot better. But if there was one scene that I could do without, it's that one where he's just in his cave chomping on a glass and basically doing like his version of Robin Williams riffing in Aladdin. You know, like there's like multiple points in Aladdin where it's like, I don't think they could actually cut around all of this improv, so they just kind of left it all in there.
That's kind of
what that's kind of what this feels like. It just goes on for way too long. But I like overall, I think this performance is a huge success. I do want to ask you about his voice, because, you know, very famously in the original, it was voiced by Boris Karloff, one of the great voices. And in this movie, Jim Carrey's like, You can tell he's kind of trying to pay homage to that voice, but he's more doing like funny Sean Connery. Like there's a lot of there's a lot of Sean Connery here. And yes. it is also a choice.
Yeah, I think it's fine.
Yeah.
That, like, his voice never bothered me. I think it fits with the character that he's trying to create.
I think it would have bothered me in a more or in a less crazy movie.
Yeah.
But like, yeah. I you got to pick your battles, honestly.
Yeah. Like if it was a very accurate live action readaptation of the animated film, but it had that voice, it would not fit. It would be over the top. But what is over the top anymore, Bob?
No, there is no top.
Redefined it.
Brad, I don't want to spoil. Actually, I do. I'm going to spoil my let's make it a double here because I don't want to wait until we get to that segment to come back to this. I do think that I saw a lot of Bert Lahr's Cowardly Lion in his performance, like from the extent of the makeup and the heaviness of the costume, but also like just the way he moves. Like I really do think Carrie was probably watching The Wizard of Oz to try to get some pointers for how to act underneath all this makeup. And you can draw a through line from the Cowardly Lion to the Grinch. There's a lot of voice similarities. There's a lot of movement similarities. I didn't know if that was something you picked up on. Like, you and I are very famously not the world's biggest Wizard of Oz guys. And we haven't talked about that movie since, I don't know, season one or two. But I kept thinking, like, what does this remind me of? And it hit me halfway through the movie. Like, it's the Cowardly Lion. And then I couldn't get it out of my head the rest of the time.
Yeah, that did not enter my consciousness. I haven't thought about The Wizard of Oz probably since we reviewed it. But I think you're 100% correct. Like when I think back on The Wizard of Oz, there is, if he didn't watch it, I would be surprised.
Yeah. Boom. I did it. I nailed it.
You did it, man. Yes. You're doing great.
Is there anyone else in this movie worth talking about, Brad?
I think the little girl's great. Taylor Momsen?
Momsen, yeah.
Yeah, I think Cindy Lou Who is really well done. I think that if the notes for Christine Baranski were just be as horny as possible, then she does a great job.
Yeah.
I don't know if I like the performance. I definitely don't like the character.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really think she's asked to do anything except be horny, so she's fine. So the mayor of this Whoville town is played by Jeffrey Tambor, very famous comedian, and I could not recognize him under the makeup and the buck teeth, but
no idea that that was him.
He looks like somebody else, and I couldn't place it. And I was thinking like, oh, this guy looks familiar. But then I saw Jeffrey Tambor, and I'm like, no, that's not who I'm thinking of. Like, even when confronted with the reality of who it was, I guess it speaks to the effectiveness of this makeup because I thought he was being played by somebody else than he actually was. This makeup is weird sometimes, Brad, because it's really good on Jeffrey Tambor. It's incredible on Jim Carrey. And then you've got different stages of it. Like with the little kids, they don't put as much makeup on them. There's like the nose, but that's about it. There's not as much prosthetics. Christine Baranski barely has any. But then you've got like Molly Shannon playing the mom, and every time she tries to like say the letter M, she can't close her lips over the teeth.
Yeah.
And so like there are points where the makeup is really distracting. And I kind of wish that they had been like, you know what? We are maximizing everything else about this movie. Like, do we really need to force this poor woman to try to speak through these teeth? Do you know what I mean?
This is not my let's make it a double, but as you're saying that, all I could think about was Remy Malek.
Bohemian Rhapsody teeth. Yes, dude.
Yes. They must have been taking notes for Bohemian Rhapsody from How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Like, oh, this is exactly what we're going for here.
All right, Brad, like, I think we've both established there's not
a
lot of...
Can I ask you one question about the script?
Sure.
At the end of the movie, you find out that the mayor isn't actually married to Christine Baranski.
Yeah, I don't really... So here's the thing. After
what
the
was
Grinch...
up with that?
After the
whole movie, they make it seem like they're married.
after the Grinch rides into town and the dad like stops the sleigh, I'm not going to lie, dude, I just completely zoned out. I don't remember a thing about the end of this movie, except that like Anthony Hopkins is narrating, right?
Oh, dude.
And even that, hot take. I love Anthony Hopkins. My guy was mailing it in. Like he wanted that check and he did everything in one take and it was like okay, but not the best.
Yeah. And no, I mean he recorded his lines in one day.
Oh yeah.
So you know.
So it shows. anyway, all that to say, I don't even remember this thing about the mayor that you're referring to. So like, yeah, through the whole movie, he's clearly got the hots for her. I don't remember thinking they were married, but then also apparently there's a reveal at the end that they weren't married. I don't know. Here's the thing, Brad. It's a
movie, Bob.
It's a 30 minute movie that they stretched into an hour and a half. I think we are at a good place, Brad, to get into our last segment of the day, which we call Let's Make It a Double.
We're near the end of the episode, so thanks for listening to the Film and Whiskey Show. Let's pair another film with this one, even if it's struggling. It's the final segment of the day, now let's make it a double.
Let's Make It a Double is the part of the show where we pick a movie to pair up with this one to make the perfect double feature. As I said, I'm going to pick The Wizard of Oz here because of the Cowardly Lion similarities, but also because, like, The Wizard of Oz is not my favorite movie. It is a significantly better film than this, and it also is a really good example of how to film sets that are very fake and still make them seem like real places that our characters are in. Because one of the biggest downsides of this movie is that the crazy camera angles just completely ruin any chance of you thinking that these people are anywhere but on a soundstage. So if you would like a better example, but also maintaining absolute wild craziness, I would say go watch The Wizard of Oz.
I think I'm going to pick another movie from the 90s that is just a great example of the wild craziness of the 90s. I am going to pair this with the Arnold Schwarzenegger-led Jingle All the Way.
Dude, as a child of the 90s, I love this movie.
Mm-hmm.
A film my wife had never seen until we got married. And when we were decorating for Christmas one year, I was like, well, let's put this on in the background. She was not into this movie, dude. Like, I don't think she hated it, but she was just like, you watched this as a kid? You liked this as a kid? What's going on? Like, it was just one of those movies, you know?
5-6-year-old Bob had much worse taste, apparently, than 10-year-old How the Grinch Stole Christmas watching Bob.
How much better would this movie have been if Arnold Schwarzenegger had been, like, the mayor or something, though?
Oh, bro. If the Grinch was played by Sylvester Stallone and the mayor was played by Schwarzenegger, yes.
Historic I'm Christmas! I'm
100% in.
All right, so there you have it. I said The Wizard of Oz. Brad said Jingle All the Way. Honestly, I think Brad wins this round. That's just such a deeply weird movie. I love it so much.
Yep, I thought it was a good match for this.
All right, Brad, let's give this some scores. I'm going to be honest with you. I was fully prepared to come in and give this movie a 2.5 out of 10 based on the first half. In fact, at the halfway point, I texted you an article I found, and I don't know if I've ever agreed with more in an article than this review of The Grinch, and it was like a complete takedown of just what an abomination this movie is. I still agree with that, but I will also say that once this movie finds a plot, you kind of stop noticing how freaking weird everything else is. Like, the filmmaking gets more propulsive. There's like a rhythm to it. You're kind of used to the garishness of it, and so you kind of don't pay attention to that anymore, and you're just along for the actual Dr. Seuss-written ride. And, like, I kind of enjoyed the second half of this movie, Brad. I didn't enjoy it enough to give it a really high score, but, Brad, I've been waffling between a 4.5 and a 5, and then you set the over under at 4.75.
Exactly where it needed to be, baby. Do I know you or do I know you?
And I'm 100% serious, dude. Like, We did not talk about this. These were the two scores that I was like, is it a 5 or is it a 4.5?
I'm gonna give it Vegas has got nothing on me, baby.
I'm gonna give it a 4.5, man. Like ending is okay, but the first half is an abomination.
Yeah. No, I'm not too far off from you, Bob. I think for me, I don't have as much angst about this movie because I really don't give a rip about the first one. That being said, this isn't a great movie, folks. There are some funny moments. For me, I'm with you that the scene of just Jim Carrey being Jim Carrey in the mountain by himself is overwrought in a movie full of of going over the top. But it has some classic lines. When he talks about not being able to cancel on himself for dinner again, it's so funny, man. Mm-hmm. So I think there's more than enough here to enjoy. I wouldn't recommend watching it more than like twice a decade. if you're a big fan, I'm like, I don't know if this movie's good for you.
If you want to, like, are you saying like if you want to preserve the magic of the movie, like you can't ruin it for yourself?
Exactly.
Got it.
So I'll give it a 6. I'll give it a 5.5 out of 10. It's fine. It was okay. It made me chuckle a few times. Not a great movie.
All right, folks, that takes us to an average of just a 5 out of 10. Brad, I have a feeling it's going to be pretty difficult for anything to come out lower than this movie on the season.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't see a world where this isn't the number 32 seed.
Michael Bay and his Transformers movies are like, challenge accepted, baby.
Yeah. I guess that's true. I mean, we have The Last Jedi. We have, there's a lot to bring us down.
So all right,
we're just starting it early in 2000.
Yeah, and we're going to continue this weird trend of like goofy monsters that we've been on with Jar Jar Binks and the Grinch. And we're going to roll into 2001 next week to look at what is apparently the internet's favorite film of all time, the DreamWorks animated Oscar winning film Shrek. Hopefully that's not going to come out to a 5 out of 10, because I don't know how many more of these I can take, Brad.
Oof.
So before we get out of here, let me say, folks, we'd love to hear what you think of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Are we out of our minds, or did we score it too high? You can let us know at any of our social media accounts, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, at Film Whiskey.
Or jump into our Discord. We have a Discord server dedicated for you guys, our fans. We love getting on there, talking to you guys, discussing anything going on in our worlds. So if you want, you can join the conversation. There's a link at the end of every single one.
Join us next week for Shrek. But until then, I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And we'll see you next time.